It is my pleasure to introduce to you Matt Walsh, one of our keynote speakers for our 2016 Bringing America Back to Life convention. Matt is a blogger, writer, speaker, and professional truthsayer with a large national following. More importantly, Matt is a husband and proud father of twins. Outside of writing, he has also hosted radio shows and podcasts and often speaks at various events and venues around the country. His topic, pro-life, the most important battle in the culture wars.
All right, thank you. That was great. Let's hear it for our comedian, because that was very... that was actually a little too good, I have to be honest. I like it if the person before me is boring, because then it... So it's all downhill from here, to be honest with you. And our singers, too. The singers were great. Can I just, you know... I would sing for you, but I've been told that I sound like a moose passing a kidney stone when I sing, which I don't think is a compliment, but I don't know. Hope you've enjoyed the conference so far. I'd never heard of, I'm like to think I'm pretty involved in the pro-life movement. It's first I've heard of this conference here in Cleveland, and I'm glad to know that it's expanding. I've enjoyed my stay so far. There's free beer. Did you guys know that? They got free beer in the bar, so that's pretty good. It's Coors Light, but, you know, so it's really more of a chore to drink. But a little bit about me to start off with. Has been covered, I'm a blogger. My parents are very proud. Because all moms and dads dream of the day that their sons and daughters will go off into the world and become bloggers. And I hope my own son gets into the family business one day. I'm already teaching him about, you know, search engine optimization skills and that sort of thing. Just very important skills to have. But I started writing my opinions online about 2 or 3 years ago. And for some reason, people fell into the delusion that my opinions matter. And so that's why I'm here today. That's what brings me here. To this important event, talking to important people. And you are important, if you don't think you are. You're here because you're fighting for life, and that makes you important. And that makes you warriors on the front lines of a epic battle. And don't be confused about this, because a lot of people don't understand. We really are warriors, and this really is a battle. Don't let the fact that, you know, we're sitting in a nice conference hall in a hotel room fool you. We are locked in a bloody and brutal culture war, and the fate of many lives and, more importantly, many souls hang in the balance. And that's what's at stake with abortion. Abortion is not an issue. You know, if you look at, you go to a website of a politician, they'll list their stances on the issues, and abortion is sometimes on that list, not for Donald Trump, but it's just listed, you know, it's just an issue. Not even a very important one. But it's not an issue at all. Abortion is nothing short of modern humanity's greatest sin. It's a cancer in the bloodstream of American society. It is a travesty of historic proportions and one that should be garnering an enormous amount of our attention, our resources, our anger. And we need to be focused on this because we're up against enormous odds, facing not only the evil of the abortion industry, which is dark and terrifying, but also the suffocating indifference of our apathetic society. Indifference that has, as far as I can tell at this point, started factions, I should say, a civil war within the movement, within the pro-life movement, within the conservative movement more broadly. And we're seeing that play out now. I wasn't planning on doing a Donald Trump thing, but I got to just mention it. Bashing Donald Trump's become my favorite hobby the last few months. No, but we are, good, yeah. We are seeing that play out now in the conservative movement, whatever we could call the conservative movement, if it even still exists. Because of, now there's a lot of things that led to this. But now we have one guy, one orange-faced megalomaniac buffoon, a tyrant. Now, this is a bad man. This is a bad man who promises to do bad things. And whatever he cares about, we've got many people in conservatism, even some pro-lifers that I've met, who decide, well, okay, we'll go that way because of him. We're going to follow him. And now all of a sudden I turn around and there's not even a consensus among conservatives that abortion matters. As long as we close the borders, that's all that matters. We could kill ourselves within those walls, but as long as we have the walls, we're fine. Is there any wall that's going to protect the kids that are being slaughtered, a million of them, every year? And this apathy has been illustrated recently, I think profoundly illustrated by the Planned Parenthood undercover videos, videos that incredibly important, urgent, horrifying. Center for Medical, what's the name of the thing? Progress, thank you. But that organization did heroic work. But the videos didn't prove anything we didn't already know. We already knew that Planned Parenthood was murdering innocent lives. We already knew, if we stopped to think about it, that this is a brutal, inhumane practice. Maybe we didn't know that they were selling the body parts afterwards. But if they weren't selling them, they're dumping them in a dumpster out back. It's always a little bit strange for pro-lifers because we're outraged that they're selling the body parts. I am outraged, but what am I saying? No, I don't sell them, dump them. Is that better? It's more of a lateral move. I don't think it's better. But the videos, the important thing they did is they put the reality of abortion out there in the open. And they said, okay, this is what abortion is, society, here it is. Are you okay with this? And millions of Americans have answered that question and said, yes, we're okay with it. So through willful ignorance or apathy or plain old indifference to the plight of dying children, millions of Americans have chosen, even now, with all we've found out, to forsake these children and carry on with their lives, which makes us a country that fails in its most basic, most fundamental duty, which is to protect and love our children. We're a country that fails to stand as one, unified in the name of life and liberty. We are a country that fails to even notice that the ground beneath us is soaked in the blood of our children. And that's why, frankly, I'm disgusted by the United States of America, to be honest with you. It's been said that if America ceases to be a good country, it will cease to be a great country. Well, we're not a good country. Got news for you. We are not. Which means we're not a great country. And we can never be called good or great as a nation until we become a nation that protects life and seeks truth. I don't want to hear that a nation can be great and kill a million babies at the same time. No. Now, this is why the pro-life movement calls all of us, and the failure to heed that call is just not acceptable anymore. Abortion is the central crisis in our civilization, and I call it that because of the millions of lives lost, but because it unravels also the fabric of civilization. It subverts the sacred institution of the family and turns children into the prey of their own parents. In our culture, we don't simply kill kids. Many countries have done that. But we hand the knife to the mother and we say, here, you do it. And abortion tells a woman to look at her child as an intruder and paradoxically as an extension of her own body, which can be discarded like garbage down the disposal. So abortion has not just destroyed those lives, but it destroys motherhood itself, which is why abortion is ground zero of the culture war. Anyone who doesn't understand this is not quite on our side, and any politician who does not understand this should never have our support. Never. Never. Pro-aborts are trying at an elemental level to take the family, which is that life-giving and life-affirming bond between parent and child, and implode it from something life-giving to life-taking, from a tree that's rooted in rich soil, bearing fruit for many generations, to an endless hole, consuming, erasing. And it's worse even than that, because these women are told that this death and destruction empowers them. And worse even than that, they're told that it's not really death and destruction, at least not permanently. One thing I've noticed about the rationale behind abortion is that often these women, when you talk to them, believe, and in fact are told, that you can abort your son or daughter and later have a redo, like a reset. And it seems, you know, you could kill your child and then have another one later, right? And it seems that there's almost this impression that you can have the exact same child again. Like abortion merely delays motherhood for a more convenient time, but it doesn't. So what are these women are saying? They say, I'm not ready to be a mother. But you are. Because upon conception, motherhood occurs. She is a mother. And if she has an abortion, she doesn't get to go back to not being a mother. Now she's simply the mother of a dead child. They're not going to hear this message from abortion clinics, because clinics are parasites that feed on delusion, abandonment, loneliness, ignorance, fear. The pro-life movement, on the other hand, what it should do anyway is shine a light. There are only two weapons that the pro-life movement should wield. Only two. Truth and love. Those are our two weapons. I'm going to say something about love here, because I'm often accused of being hateful when I talk about abortion or when I talk about anything. Really? Because if you're passionate, if you mean it, God forbid you raise your voice in this culture these days, everyone's like, oh, you're being hateful. Stop it. No, I care. Is what I'm caring is what I'm doing. This is what you see. This is me caring right now. It's a little scary, I know, but here's the thing. I do hate abortion. I hate it. I hate it so much. I hate it more than anything in the world. I hate it. But I do not feel hatred for the women who get abortions. I never feel hatred for them. I realize that they're victims here as well. They've been lied to, taken advantage of, used, abused, tossed aside. They're going to have to carry this weight of their decision for the rest of their lives. And the abortion industry will just leave them to it, to their grief and despair. So we have to reach out with healing and with love and end the cycle of violence and guilt that leads to more abortions. And for women who are contemplating abortion, hatred will not save the child's life. The best thing we can do is hold out a hand and say, I love you. Don't be afraid. You know, in Luke chapter 1, the angel of the Lord visits Zechariah to tell him his wife, Elizabeth, will be giving birth to a child. And a few lines later, which is 6 months in real time, the angel visits, well, they got to condense things a little bit, you know, the Bible. The angel visits Mary with news that she's bearing a child, Jesus. And in both cases, I think it's so powerful and relevant that one of the first things the angel says to both of them is, do not be afraid. That should be the motto of the pro-life movement. Do not be afraid. You contrast that with the abortion industry's message, which is be afraid, be very afraid, you're doomed. Abortion is indeed a product of fear. All evils are products of fear, but abortion stands apart from other evils in our culture because it is so entirely dark and depraved, right down to its core. Something straight from the pit of hell is abortion. I have no doubt that if the devil came to earth in physical form and wanted to find a job, it would apply to be an abortionist at Planned Parenthood. They'd be very impressed with his resume. Of course, recent evidence suggests he could just run for president and might get elected, but, you know. But if you peek under the shiny veneer of our progressive modern society, under all the happy slogans and the catchy hashtags and the rainbow flags, you'll find the corpses of 50 million dead children, decaying and ignored and forsaken by our culture of emasculated narcissists. And what you see there, which is gruesome and infuriating, is an indictment on our society and on all of us. And it's also the very rotting heart of our society. We call ours the culture of death, because our culture's dominant ideology, liberalism, is in the end a death cult. And I've long suggested that we stop calling it liberalism or progressivism or whatever, and start calling it secular Satanism, because that's truly the most accurate and coherent way to describe it. The whole religion and ideology of Satanism / liberalism was born when Satan himself turned from God and said, "I will not serve." It was the birth of evil. And what better or more profound way for humans to reinforce that point than to ritualistically massacre his most precious and vulnerable children? Now, we have to understand that abortion evangelists are pro-abortion in principle, not out of some sense of necessity or compassion. They believe, they have faith, a religious faith, that the individual is supreme. There's no power above the individual, the mighty me, as I call it. And nothing can impose itself on me. And nothing, not even my own child, can claim any right to my life or my body or my money or my time, because it's mine. I am the sole point and purpose of the universe, and the highest thing I can hope to attain is my own enjoyment, convenience, and especially sexual pleasure. To our culture, there is no truth outside of that. There is no God beyond myself. And we should understand that every other me can live in their own bubble of self-gratification and self-worship, and we're always told we shouldn't get involved. Let people do what they're going to do. Doesn't affect us. If two of the me's happen to bump into one another, it's best if they're polite simply because it feels good to be polite to each other. This is why the only Bible verse that many in our culture cite, aside from don't judge, which isn't actually a Bible verse, there's some qualifications to that point, by the way. Jesus wasn't saying never make a judgment about anything. Anyway. But the other one is love your neighbor as yourself. That is in the Bible. And it's an important point. Jesus said it. It's important, okay? I endorse. Now, they take this to mean that self-love is the highest love. I mean, that we should calibrate our love for others based on how much we love ourselves. Because that's the point. That's the beginning point, is the love we have for ourselves. But they miss the whole rest of Scripture, which explains in great detail that we love God above everything and everybody, including ourselves, including our families, including our kids and our wives and our husbands. We love God first. And that through our love for God, we come to truly love ourselves and our neighbors. Our satanic culture removes God from that equation, leaving only the self, which cuts off the source and purpose of the love, turning it quickly into indifference and then hatred. And that's why the other me's don't always have to be afforded respect, you'll notice, or even basic human dignity. The moment one of them becomes a burden, which is the only sin you can commit these days, the moment they ask us to change or give or serve or love in any sort of active way, is when they transform into a gross parasite to be extracted and discarded. The ultimate example of this, of course, is abortion, and the point is driven home when the babies are killed and then cut up and used for medical research, because we, the mighty me's, think nothing of attempting to extend our own lives by cannibalizing our children. After all, I'm me. What greater cause is there than the extension of my own existence? When you consider this, it starts to make sense that abortion fans have finally abandoned the whole safe, legal, and rare thing. That was a quaint little phase in the pro-death movement, wasn't it? Safe, legal, and rare. Never see those signs anymore. The only people left who prattle on about the fantastical rare abortion are moderate conservatives and Christians who think child murder should be totally illegal, except in the rare case of rape and incest, in which case the baby's out of luck. Yeah, we got to kill a few hundred. No big deal, right? Let's be pragmatic. Everybody else, though, has established a more absolutist position on the subject. True pro-lifers think abortion should never be legal, and pro-choicers, quote-unquote, think it should never be limited. That's what we're dealing with. And it makes sense. You know, their point of view makes sense here. It's consistent. It's finally consistent, which is why it scares me a little bit. Because they're finally being consistent. And I was afraid that they would come. Why should a woman be empowered only rarely? They're asking. Why should she be permitted to exercise her autonomy over her body only in rare circumstances? If abortion is legal and acceptable because the life of the child is meaningless and the convenience of the mother is sacrosanct, why in the world should we try to reduce the frequency by which these meaningless things are terminated for the sake of protecting a more important person's lifestyle? Why should we do that? It doesn't make any sense. If anything, it should happen more often. It's a celebration of that woman's autonomy, isn't it? And that's the way they're starting to look at it. This is why progressives also don't bother much with arguments over the personhood of the fetus, quote unquote, anymore. You know, they throw it out there as a standard defense sometimes, but it's not that essential to their cause. They don't care that much anymore about that. They don't. Whether the unborn entity is a person or a human or a moose or a space alien, a cantaloupe, it doesn't matter. Abortion is permissible and even laudable purely because the woman wants it, period, end of sentence. That's how they look at it. I felt like having an abortion, so I did. The end. That's the most popular justification for murder these days. I did it because I wanted to. It's not exactly Socrates, but it's a convincing argument. If you're not grounded in anything, spiritually. And it's the kind of logic that, when accepted and adopted, begins to eat away at your soul. Because abortion is an all-or-nothing proposition, and propagators of modern progressive philosophy are all in. They've thrown all their chips on the table, which is why we should too. And, sorry, thanks, yeah. And there's good reason for their abortion infatuation, because it can be said that if our culture were right about abortion, it would be right about everything else. The value of human life would be relative to how desirable that life is to those around it. And if human life is relative, then the ideas at the root of our country, inalienable rights endowed by a creator, yada, yada, and so forth, can't be objectively true. God himself cannot be objectively true. If abortion is okay, then there is no God. And this is the difficulty that Christians who are okay with abortion run into. You're accepting something that disproves your entire faith if it's true. Your faith is pointless. If we can determine the worthiness of human life, then we are gods. And truth is whatever we say it is. So either God is God or we are. We've got to make up our minds on that one. And this is what makes abortion a defining issue. It gets right down to the fundamentals of who you are and what you believe. It plants you firmly on the side of objective truth and human dignity, or firmly against it. And everything, wherever, whatever else you believe, will grow from that root. This is the epicenter of America's vast ideological divide. Being pro-life is then, apart from a mere argument or cause, the purpose. It informs, directs, gives substance to every other argument we have on every other subject. It all comes back to abortion, because if human life has no intrinsic value, then none of this other stuff matters. None of it. Intrinsic means belonging to a thing by its very nature. This is why we oppose abortion. It destroys innocent life, and innocent life has intrinsic value. Simple, logical, consistent. And people say, but what about, but nothing. But nothing, buddy. These buts do not negate the value of the life in question. You can throw out the rarest, most tragic, most gut-wrenching scenario you like, and it will not change the answer because it does not change the question. And the question is, does human life have intrinsic value? Our answer is yes, and it must always be yes. Always. And we have to shout that yes. There's a campaign now among the pro-abortion movement called Shout Your Abortion. I don't know if you've seen this on Twitter. Women brag about their abortions on Twitter. They shout about them. So we have to shout that human life has value. Let me tell you something about that. That resonates. Resonates more than anything else, more than any other argument we can come up with. It's the only argument they don't have a response to. People know that life is sacred. They know it. It's natural law. It's ingrained in us. Out of our selfishness, spite, laziness, whatever, we can convince ourselves we don't know it. But rarely can a person entirely fool themselves, you'll notice, which leads to one of the great ironies in modern culture, that the pro-abortion side, and many people have remarked on this, the pro-abortion side also tends to be the most adamantly pro-environment and pro-animal rights. They weep over the death of a sycamore tree, or remember Cecil the Lion, the poor guy, killed, mercilessly killed by a rampaging dentist. And they weep over that, but not over the child. And there's something good, though. Now, I think all this environmentalist stuff, and some, I'm okay with animals, but whatever, you kill a lion, I don't care. But so I think it's a little silly, but deep down, even though their priorities are way out of whack, they still recognize the life in that tree and in that cat, and they revere it. So our job is very simple, to get them to open up their hearts a little wider, cast a wider net, see the whole picture. Our job is to send them down the rabbit hole. We ask questions like, okay, you're very sad that a tree or a lion died. Why? And they'll say, it's majestic and beautiful and, whatever. And you say, okay, why does that matter? There are other beautiful things. There are other animals. Why do we need these? Who cares if they're exterminated from the face of the earth? What does it matter? Because it'll upset the ecosystem. Okay, but who cares about the ecosystem? Why does the ecosystem matter? Because all living organisms depend on it. Okay, but why does that matter? Brings us back to the original question. Who cares about the living organisms? And while we're at it, why do we instinctively place some organisms over others? Why aren't you upset when I kill a cockroach, but you would be if I killed a bald eagle, for instance? If I swat a fly, you probably won't cry. If I, set a kitten alive, burned a kitten on fire or something. It's getting more graphic than it needs to go, sorry. I'm not a fan of cats. I'm really not. I don't know if people own those things, but anyway, you get the point. Let's say we drowned a kitten, okay? Now, I'm just spitballing here. Okay, don't film this part. Is that filming? No. But what is life anyway? Why does it matter? What makes it valuable? What makes some life more valuable than others? Why is your neighbor more significant than the tree in his front yard? Why do we weep when life is taken? Why do we usually celebrate when life is born? Why are the trees and lions here? Why should the lions and trees be treated with dignity? Why should you be treated with dignity? If you answer these questions, you can only come to one of two conclusions. There are only two available. It's all meaningless and nothing matters, so just kill everything. Or life is inherently sacred, especially human life. Confront these mysteries and you will end up either a suicidal nihilist or a pro-life zealot. There is no room in between. This is why everything comes back to this mission, back to this room. Because we pro-lifers have answers to those questions, don't we? And the answer is, life is sacred. And until we can convince our culture of this, until we can show them this, until we can prove this, there's not any hope of making any progress on any other topic. We have to defeat the underlying nihilistic premise that says human life has no worth and no dignity, or that the worth and dignity is relative to circumstance. That's why I'm a big believer, by the way, that although there's nothing wrong with concentrating intently on abortion, we cut ourselves off at the knees if we don't extend that pro-life principle to every issue, which is, you heard about that earlier. And not just the obvious things like euthanasia, stem cell research, etc., but things like even pornography, for instance, which violates the dignity of the human person. Gay marriage violates the sanctity of the family and of marriage. The whole point is that pro-life is an absolute declaration. It is not something that can be parsed and divided and sectioned off. And we are pro-life entirely or not at all. And the world needs us to be pro-life entirely. Now, if you'll indulge me for a minute, I want to go a little off track here. How much time do I have? Is that a timer for me? 14 minutes? Oh, man. You guys are really finding me here. I was going to go for at least 3 hours. Now, half of what I've said so far is not in my notes because I just, ADHD thing, I'm with you, man. Now, I want to go a little off track here. I want to take a sort of step aside and make another note. Address a specific group of people who I think are not specifically brought into the pro-life discussion often enough. And I was thinking about this today. I wasn't planning on, and then I had some arguments on Facebook with some pro-abortion women who are usually not fans of my work, to put it mildly. And I ended up just feverishly typing notes about what I want to say right now, which is unrelated really to anything else. But I want to take a minute to address men directly. It's crucial, obviously, that women are engaged in the pro-life cause, and so many are, which is great. But I've noticed, especially among my generation, a hesitancy in men, which also puts it mildly. They feel they're not allowed to speak up. It doesn't involve them. It's none of their business. Now, I feel qualified to speak to men on this because if you hadn't noticed, I am a man. That's how I identify as a man also. So, no, it's very important. And I have an opinion about abortion, which you may have noticed that as well. Even more shocking, I didn't consult with the Feminist High Council before formulating my opinion. I didn't check the rule book to make sure my man opinions are within the spectrum of approved perspectives for someone of my anatomical persuasion. I didn't fill out, you know, the forms I guess you're supposed to fill out, requesting permission to publicly voice my man beliefs. I just sort of came up with them. Lord, forgive me. It's a big crime these days, especially on college campuses, to go off on your own and start thinking. And that's what I did. I generated a point of view, defies the established orthodoxy, and not satisfied to keep my man opinions to my man self, I've gotten into the nasty habit of telling people about them. And I may have gotten away with my man thought crimes if I had just shut up, but it's too late for that now. And now every time that I mention abortion, I'm reminded by pro-abortion women that I have no right to contribute to the discussion due to my shameful lack of a vagina. You're a man, they observe, and pat themselves on the back like they just answered all my arguments. Like, oh, okay, well, you win. All right. And it's like, kind of like nabbing low-hanging fruit here to address the proposition that only women can have an opinion about abortion, but it's a very convincing argument, especially in my generation. A lot of people actually think this. So I feel it necessary to point out, first of all, that truth is not subject to your genitalia. File this in the things that shouldn't need to be said out loud category, but abortion is a moral question, a legal question, a scientific question, a question of truth and reality and reason. Now, I'm not a doctor, but I'm fairly sure your genitalia will not whisper the answers to these questions to you. I don't know. I fell asleep in biology class, but I don't think that's in there. The answers can be ascertained by listening not to your reproductive organs, but to your conscience and by researching the facts. And these are activities that are generally open to both genders, although members of both groups rarely engage in them in these days, but you can do them. And here's what it comes down to. Abortion is murder or it is not. Unborn children are people or they are not. It is morally acceptable to kill an innocent human being or it is not. A woman cannot change the objective answers to these questions, and neither can a man. Now, a woman does have an emotional insight into this subject. That's important, having many of them carried and birthed children themselves. But an insight into the truth is not the same as an ability to alter it. Pro-abortion progressivism tells us that reproduction is an activity unique to females, which is a scientific theory that third grade biology education would debunk, but we'll get to that in a minute. But and then it tells us that men can't have anything relevant to say about it. But the trouble is that progressivism seeks to brutalize and ultimately eliminate that which is unique to women. It's the pro-lifers, both men and women, who love and respect the unique characteristics of womanhood. It is the pro-life movement that displays a real knowledge of and appreciation for the female body and the female experience. Pro-aborts, on the other hand, are experts in womanhood in the same way that, you know, an arsonist is an expert in architecture. He knows how to burn it down. And that's all he's interested in doing. Now, I got to skip ahead. I had like 8 other points on this. The second point is that, of course, you know, you need 2 people to reproduce. I probably don't need to get into that, but we all understand that, right? Men and women come together. Birds and, you guys got that talk, right? Okay. It's going to be really awkward. I wasn't planning it. So let's skip ahead to the third point. And this is the most important one. Men are duty-bound to oppose abortion. It's our duty. Now, it's no surprise that men who support abortion also quite magnanimously, in most cases, support a woman's right to go out half-naked, get drunk, sleep with strangers. They're very generous, these men. These are men who rise up like white knights to defend Kim Kardashian when she posts another one of her biweekly nude selfies on Twitter. Don't body shame her, they say. Let women diminish themselves and desperately flaunt their naked bodies for attention. We have no right to criticize them. Let them do it. True heroes. Or it could be that they rather enjoy watching women debase themselves, just as they enjoy encountering drunk women with low standards and no self-respect. And because they enjoy these things so much, they certainly will be very supportive when the women they take advantage of choose to terminate the consequences, thereby relieving these generous men of all responsibility. They say they support abortion because they respect women, but the reality is exactly the opposite, of course. The men who conceive children are very supportive when the woman considers abortion are not actually supportive at all. Supporting is precisely the thing they're trying to avoid. A man has a duty to his child. When you support a woman's decision to kill your own son or daughter, you have shirked that duty in the worst possible way. And men have a duty not just to their own children, but to society generally. Men should be protectors of the innocent and warriors for truth and dignity. Men are called to show strength. To show leadership, moral clarity. Men are commanded to stand in the gap, as it says in Scripture. Men who fail in this regard do so out of fear, never out of tolerance or respect. The pro-abortion movement, just another sinister force in America, convincing men to be weak, selfish, and submissive. And in fact, cowardly, emasculated men are the primary beneficiaries, really the only beneficiaries, of feminism. Thanks to feminism, they're excused from the duties of fatherhood, excused from the duty of taking principled and virtuous stands in defense of the innocent, and for their troubles, they get to watch a bunch of empowered women post naked selfies all over the internet. Feminism kills babies, destroys women, but spineless men make out like bandits. But for those of us who do not wish to accept the gifts feminism wants to give us, we must continue to barge into the discussion and rudely involve ourselves in issues like abortion, because that is our responsibility. Notice I'm not saying men should speak out against abortion even though they're men. I'm saying they ought to speak out because they are men. And we're already in bad shape when men in our culture simply fail to be moral leaders. We are doomed when they decide they have no right to be leaders, or that stepping aside and failing to lead is somehow a virtuous act. So the world needs all of us, men and women, to stand firm and testify unwaveringly to the simple truth that life has meaning, life has value, life is sacred. This is not a choice, it's a calling. It's a command from heaven. So I want to leave you with, I might go a few minutes over, just a couple. I want to leave you with an image that I share sometimes at these events. It's not a vision or a dream or anything. It's just a sense that I have, a thought articulated by others, Fulton Sheen and others. So I often imagine my day of judgment. I imagine waking up, confused, naked, surrounded by light. Have you imagined this moment? Not my judgment. A lot of people have thought about my judgment with glee, but thought about your own, because I've thought about my own. And the first thing I think about is the light and how it's brighter than anything I've ever seen, but not blinding, and hotter than anything I've felt, but not burning. And there I am, I imagine, and there in front of me is him, Christ. And I imagine standing before Christ in that day, whenever it comes, could be in 2 hours, could be in 70 years, who knows. I imagine that he towers there above me. He's immense, eternal, beautiful, terrifying. And I imagine that I'm too petrified to look at him. And I just collapse and I weep like a child. And I beg for mercy. That's what I imagine about Jesus. Not that I see him and he's my best friend. I'm like, hey, buddy. And he's not my friend. He's my God. And I'm standing there before him. And I imagine that he speaks. I don't imagine what he sounds like, just that he speaks. And his eyes are looking at me and they're bigger than planets. And his face is like the sun. And I feel bigger and smaller than I've ever felt in this moment. Small because I'm a lowly, lowly, lowly servant in the presence of my master. But big because I finally understand what I should have known all along, but I was too stupid to see it. That the great power in the universe is looking right at me. I'm not standing in a vacuum. I'm on a platform attracting the complete attention of God himself. And I imagine that we have a conversation, but it's rather one-sided. There isn't much I can say or need to say. There's no bargains anymore. There's no excuses. It's over now. He's looking at me, through me, into me, seeing my thoughts. I'm completely exposed. He's finally passing his judgment. And I don't know what will be said. But I imagine one question, and I'm so sure that we'll be asked this. I imagine that he looks at me, just as he will look at you, and ask, what did you do for my little ones? I sent millions of children to you while you were on earth, and you sent millions back. What did you do about that? What did you give to them? What did you do to defend and protect my most helpless and vulnerable children? What did you do? And if I've done what I needed to, I imagine there will be a choir of voices, the aborted children who are complete and whole and beautiful again, crying out that the Lord will take mercy on me. But if I've done nothing, if I failed to even try, if I sat back and let it happen, if I cared more about my stupid reputation, my convenience, my money, than loving my Lord's children and striving to help and protect them. If that's the case, then I imagine silence. Terrible silence, deafening silence. And I imagine those agonizing, fatal words that he promised he would say to some of us. And we like to pretend that he never said this, but he did. Promised some of us would hear, "Depart from me. I never knew you." Despite the fact that I'm speaking here at an event like this, I cannot honestly tell you I'm confident that the choir of voices will be there for me to come to my defense. I can't honestly tell you I'm confident that I'm doing enough. I cannot tell you that. And I wish I could. But I can pledge to try harder, to give more, to sacrifice more, to care more, to stand for these children who are dying and these women who are hurting, and to say, "You're not alone. I'm here for you. I will help you." Because that's my calling. And it's yours too. And so to any of you who've given all you can, done everything you can with your life for this cause, then I applaud you. And I admire you. And I urge you to keep going until the end of your life. But if you're in my camp and you feel like you could give more, could do more, could be involved more, then I urge you to heed the call. There's not a lot of time left. And now is the time to stand for life. Thank you.
You've been listening to Matt Walsh, popular writer and blogger, and a 2016 Bringing America Back to Life convention speaker.